Conference record has joined the conference.
Okay, so you're on.
On.
What?
Yep.
No, I
have
a regular account. Free will.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, if we may, I would like to convene the New York Medicaid Redesign Payment Reform and Quality Measurement Workgroup. My name is Bill Streck. I'm a co-chair with Dan Sisco. I'm here in my role as the chair of the Public Health and Health Planning Council. I want to welcome all of you, give you a sense of our approach today. We will begin going through our agenda following introductions. We have a presentation that we anticipate will define lunchtime by its termination. So we will leave that open and allow full discussion there. I want to point out that Dan and I are honored to chair this group. The fact that we were willing to chair a group on payment reform in New York State has afforded us other opportunities, and so we're on a tight time frame. We need to go to Washington to deal with the budget super committee and then off to New York for the Palestinian question. So so we thought we would start with the most difficult of the three.
The traffic is terrible.
We'll begin today. I welcome you all, and I think what we'll do is, why don't we start introductions over here, Pat? Why don't we come this way to me, and then Dan can take over and make remarks, and we'll finish the introduction, Pat.
I'm Pat Long from the CEO of Culture. Paloma Hernandez, I'm the CEO of Urban Rhonda Kovalchuk, CEO of the Primary Care Development Corporation. I'm Susan Stewart. I'm Executive Director of SYNC in the Hudson Valley.
I'm Donna Frescator of the Governor's Office.
Jim Talon from United Hospital Fund and returning to my roots.
Scott Cooper, CEO of St. Barnabas in the Bronx.
Joanne Cunningham, I'm the CEO of the Home Care Association.
John Alberg from the Health Department, and I'm glad to be here, not on my way to Bennington because we were off on the wrong road.
Steve Safier, Montague. Dan Sisto, Haney's, and I'll make my remarks in a minute.
Roberta Rinsky with Independent Health. I'm representing Dr. Kraft. He couldn't be here today.
Rick Abrams, Medical Society of the State of New York.
Phyllis Lanto from New York Presbyterian.
Joe Quigley out of South Mesa Hospital.
Emma DeVito, CEO of Village Care.
Elizabeth Benjamin, I'm at the Community Service Society of New York.
Art Levin, Southern Medical
Department. So welcome, everybody, and especially appreciate the support over the last couple of weeks from the Department of Health in dealing with a couple of months, really, in the Governor's Office and trying to get this MRP Phase 2 process off the ground, and the various subcommittees, some of which have had considerable progress, some of which are just starting off now, but all of which is intended to obviously influence our capability of meeting the budget targets that were laid out earlier this year in the budget in the MRP 1. And the complexity of it, transforming a health system in the context of a budget cap, but also in the context of the Affordable Care Act, and also in the context of deficit reduction, is obviously going to be a pretty extremely arduous task. But I take a little heart from the actions of our congressmen and congresswomen. You would think when the rest of the country is showing the benefits of total polarization, meaning no benefit, but the fact that the New York delegation was able to come together and do a joint letter to the committee to talk about the issues affecting our healthcare system is really a little tiny beacon of light in a rather relatively bleak political landscape. And it was the actions of consumer groups and provider groups weighing in on that delegation that I think will enable us now to take that letter and use it as a model across the country, that even in this kind of situation, bipartisanship is possible. So maybe we can take some hope from that, that even our formidable goals and objectives that have been laid out for us by the administration and the department and the MRT work the last year is conceivably accomplishable, as formidable as it is. And had has builded to work with the governor's office in trying to frame a working group here of people whose track record speak for themselves in terms of both leadership and openness, objectivity, and creativity. So I think we've got one of the more sterling working groups on the whole of the set. And so with that, the task is formidable in itself. John's going to walk us through, predominantly John's going to walk us through a set of slides today to help, I think, frame the issues for us, give some hints as to what the most difficult obstacles may be, the most difficult challenges. And there's a great deal of material, of course, in the handout. You might have had a chance to review some of it. One of the things we talked about over the last week and leading up to today was to see if we could even get a common understanding of definitions that we're talking about. One of the problems we have when I deal with even my own membership is nursing homes, hospitals, hospices, home care, et cetera, and people hear words and they mean different things by them. Even the most famous catch-all of all, the Accountable Care Organization, seems to mean 50 different things. If we start getting a little bogged down in something and not quite sure, the glossary, in effect, is at the back and might help us. So, John?
Sure. Thank you for joining us. As you can see here, we have a very ambitious agenda there. I'm sure we'll live up our full 4-hour time frame here. I think one of the things is that we have a very, group here, and that was certainly all very intentional. I think this is more slanted towards acute care in nature, but there's obviously some folks here have the same important roles as it relates to long-term care, and that's intentional because there's a lot of crossover issues that we would like to be able to represent fairly. So I just wanted to say that when you look at the agenda and we go through the slides, that maybe a reaction, but we want to make sure people understood that that was. So this is the agenda. We'll step through all of this today. When I talked to Dan, I said, would you prefer that I just go through the segments of the slides and then take questions? I think what we would prefer is that, when people have questions or have thoughts, you raise those. Obviously, we worked with many of you before. We know that you're not bashful, and we appreciate that. That's one of the reasons why we're all here, because we want to hear your voice. So with that, I'll just start with unless anybody has any other questions or want to talk around rules or get anything. Okay. So,
let's go with the next slide there.
I thought what we would start is just give you a general update on where we are with the MRT process. I'm sure many of you have been following our progress along the way. I think we can all kind of get grounded. We thought we'd spend a couple of minutes just talking about where we've been thus far. The first thing I'll say is on behalf of the commissioner, we would like to thank you, sincerely thank you for volunteering your time to participate on this work. You were selected, as Dan said, because you're a leader in your area, you have a voice, you would very much want to hear that voice. So I wanted to say that. I think many of you have served on these panels before. I've served with you on various panels. I think what may change, what may make difference than other experiences is that I think given the pressures of that you're all under, and a lot of them are fiscal pressure, just given the state of the economy and what's going on at the state and federal level, that it's important that we make some fundamental changes. And I think if there's one thing in my mind that kind of differentiates, the environment from yesterday to the environment today, pressure, and I think that pressure is really an opportunity. So, I think the other thing I'd like to do is just, from the very beginning is thank, the Haney staff and the DOA staff for putting this presentation together. A lot of effort goes into this. I think what you'll find is that, we're here to make sure that this is a successful experience, for all of us, that we're committed, to providing whatever information you need. We're here to kind of serve you. I think before we get going, I think the governor obviously recognized that these were his words, his fifth day in office, that we needed to make fundamental changes and restructure the Medicaid program. And he realized that early on. He established the MRT to accomplish that, and it was, I think, rather bold and decisive move on his part, and I think it is thus far paying dividends to the healthcare system, but there's obviously
more work for us to do. I think one thing that I will point out is that not this year, but the year before, I had the opportunity to go to the United Hospital Fund annual session, and I was in the audience, and I had the opportunity to listen to Dennis, Waylon, and Deborah, and Mr. Town, and I think the points that were being articulated was that policy development in New York State was broken. You know, it was not an open process. My days at DOB, I was in the sausage factory where you see how health care policy was being made, and it wasn't open. I think it's all being done behind closed doors for the most part. Folks like you trying to get a voice in the matter, and all being condensed into a matter of, you know, 2 months in essence, to try to get your health care policy development in place for the following year. I think what the governor has done with the MRT and listening to you is basically turn that on its head. You know, we're here now to hear what your voice is and basically take the timeline for making policy and stretching it out over a longer period of time. So I think if there's one thing about the process that I've taken away from it is it's really put more of a voice in the hands of the stakeholder than what was there before. And people can debate that, debate the policy. We're always willing to, you know, change our process along the way, but that's certainly one of the things that I've taken away from it from where I sit. Okay, next slide on the 5th, as I said, you know, the governor established the MRT. The MRT was, you know, charged with covering ways to save money and improve quality within the Medicaid program, and we, given the fiscal constraints at the time, the decision was made phase one would address the current year budget situation, phase two, which is what we're in now, we would pursue, you know, more comprehensive reform. So that was the game plan. What came out of MRP phase one, 79 reform proposals. We met our budget target, and I can tell you that, you know, what was on the table before MRP was a lot different than what came out of the process. A lot different. And I think, you know, kudos to all of us, you know, for shaping that. And you know, what came out of it is, you know, we took care of our business, we saved $2.2 billion. Somewhere in the neighborhood of $640 million of that was, you know, kind of, you know, industry-led savings, we called it, but it's just wait and see how the things play out under the global cap. We will give you a full report on the global cap when we have our larger session, you know, with the MRT, but I think at this point, you know, we're looking pretty good, and hopefully, you know, we stay there. Next year, the target goes up to $3.3 billion, but the thing that I will point out is that our target, which is what matters the most, is $15.3 billion this year, and it goes to $15.9 billion next year. So we have $600 million growth built into the numbers that you see there. So that's in my mind, you know, we introduced reform proposals that facilitate, you know, significant structural reform, a little bit of Medicaid cost curve, achieve savings without any cuts in eligibility. Phase two is itself a multi-year quality improvement care management plan to tackle the issues that we have before us. We've been subdivided into MRT work groups, and we've signed work groups, you know, complex issues that we're not addressing phase one, and then our goal is to give something for the governor to review in December of 2011. And these are the work groups, managed long-term care, behavioral health. Those folks are all in, had multiple meetings and well along the path of developing the recommendations, streamlined state and local responsibilities. Another group, health systems redesign. The working group is significant overlap between us and that group, which we'll talk about, payment reform and quality. That's up. Basic benefit review. Greg Allen is participating with that group with Dr. Shaw. Health disparities is another group that we've been asked to stay in touch with to make sure that in the policy that we develop are consistent with the health disparity recommendation. This is our timeline here, and I'll quickly, you know, step through it. We'll have a chance to get together on the 5th of October as a large group, so all of us, plus
with all the other 9 other groups. We'll get together on the 5th. It was initially scheduled for today, the 20th, but it got pushed out for a number of reasons. What we'll do with that meeting is lay out the timeline so everybody is, you know, working together and see how the pieces will eventually come together. Myself, my folks, my team, and the DOB group will provide an update on the cast. We are with implementation. We'll have August data at least by then to report. It's not going to be in September. It's a good chance to introduce folks. The co-chairs will provide a brief, you know, update to the entire group, and we'll be at that point in our process will be along the way and have something to say. The way that we, again, because we have 9-10 groups, and to keep us all organized, we've been divided up into different waves. So the first wave, which is the wave of health reform program, streamlining stable responsibilities, and long-term care group, they will, you know, present their recommendations on the 15th. On the 1st, on or about the 1st, they will vote on their wave, on the wave one. Recommendations. Also on that date, we'll be prepared to put forward our work group recommendations. So we really have to come now and November 1st put together recommendations. On the 15th, third wave, the final work group recommendations are due. And then on December 1st, it's the MRC meeting where there'll be a vote both on wave 2 and 3. So we all get together on the 5th. On November 1st, we have our work group recommendations. We have our basically a format for which we'll develop those recommendations. And then on the 1st, there'll be a vote. And it all ends up on the governor's desk by the 31st. And this is all timed in such a way that in the event that we do need some sort of assistance or input from the legislature, it gets incorporated. So there's a lot there, no doubt. Okay. So, I mean, at this point, I can take a break and just say, I just threw a lot at you. It's mostly administrative. Yeah.
I got an email from someone who's trying to listen in, and they can't really hear you. I'm wondering if maybe you should speak.
Yes.
There you go.
And I was told to do this, by the way. And the other thing I think I was told to do.
I will email and find out if that's better.
Yeah, hopefully it will. And I think what I will also do is, as I'm going through the slides, I will say what page I'm on, and I will forget at least 6 times. So if one of you guys can kick me along the way, I appreciate that. Good thing. Okay, so any questions thus far? Because if not, then I will turn more to the meat of the matter. Yeah,
thank you. Just one question. As far as the recommendations that are going to move forward come November 1st from this work group, are they just going to be the recommendations that impact on the 2012-2013 budget, or will it also include the longer range things that I would expect that we would put together that really will put us on a correct glide path?
I think we're thinking, in phase two, we're thinking longer range. So not only does it have to, you know, if there are savings or spending that we think need to get incorporated in next year's budget, we'll note that as part of the recommendation. But I think at this stage of where we are in the process, we're thinking longer term.
Not only for the state, but if we decide to go for a federal waiver, the thoughts of this group particularly could feed, you know, what we're asking for to help stimulate reform. Hopefully they'll find it.
Any other questions? Okay, I'll just keep moving here. This is Mr. Sisto's slide here, which I think is very appropriate for the time. And certainly, I think back in Mr. Darwin's time as well. So what we're going to discuss here is just kind of a recap of what we think the charges of our work group, what the goals are of the work group, and then some suggested guiding, you know, principles. So
on slide 12, here's our charge, right? Develop a series of payment reforms and quality measurement recommendations to facilitate the transformation of our healthcare system. Pretty straightforward, a lot there. You have to kind of look at it and absorb it, but that's why we're here. The goals, focused activities, recommend how New York State can encourage the development of innovative payment and delivery models, explore and identify evidence-based quality indicators to benchmark New York's Medicaid program and the provider delivery system, explore issues in the New York State disproportionate share program and related indigent care funding mechanisms, consider criteria that can be used to identify safety net providers and the implications of such a designation on local planning, finance, care delivery, and oversight. And that's the connection to Mr. Berger's group there. Time permitting, we'll look at payment for workforce education, including GME, workforce shortages, IT investment, and opportunities to access capital finance. Each one of these could be their own MRT group, I think, right? That's for sure. I think we've decided to try to tackle all of these because all these pieces are connected.
One question. Yeah. The PEP pool would be part of indigent care or part of the GME bundle?
Well, there's, definitely, connections. I think on indigent care, we have a whole, separate section here, yes, to talk about. And I'll allude to it here now. Part of how far we're going to go with indigent care is going to require CMS to weigh in on how they envision, the formula that they think states should follow so that we don't have to take a disproportionate share of the cut, right, in 2014, right? We all understand that when, health reform kicks in, nationwide they're going to cut, right, indigent care, $500 million. That's year one, right? We want to make sure, right, that we have a formula, right, that is in general conformance with where the feds want us to go so we don't have to take larger than our share of that cut. We asked CMS, and we've been on them for the past couple of weeks so we could report here. They told us yesterday that they do not yet have guidance available to us. So that, in essence, may change our work here some, and that's, I think, why we use the word, explore issues, because we certainly want to, use this group, to understand what the issues are. But I also think we need to hear where CMS is trying to point us so that we're...
I think it's important that, in addition, we be in sync with what CMS would endorse or needs to endorse. But we also keep in mind... impacts of what has already been crafted and its impact especially on New York to fund basically an upside in new insurers elsewhere and not as much here. Therefore, we should be mindful that we don't cause double damage.
Exactly.
Because there are things they're gonna do no matter what, and they're not designed to help the Northeast or New York. Or our teaching programs, or our care for the indigent. And what would be really silly is if we suggested a series of reforms that made sense in a vacuum. We're not in a vacuum. We need to look at that as a holistic piece. I think that should be a guideline for us as we develop this.
I think the only thing I will add to that...
I'm not trying to be cryptic. The things that they cut to support the newly insured, which is the right thing to do for the country, for people that are uninsured, take money from what we've been using in this state to either support people without insurance or people who are grossly underinsured. And we shouldn't cause more damage because it's not going to help. Those initiatives are not helping New York, especially not helping places like the Bronx, Brooklyn, whatever.
Exactly. And the only thing I would add to that is, there's big significant cuts on the Medicare DISH side as well. And we need to make sure that we're coordinating those.
That's where I'm going.
The only other thing I would say, and I know you said this was mostly focused on the acute care side,
But as I look at those activities, and if I'm thinking about 2012 and 2013 and beyond, you know, we really have to think about the long-term care side, you know, as you think about safety net providers, you know,
yes.
Is there access issues in small communities or urban areas? We need to think about planning for those.
Absolutely.
And I think that would fit in the first bullet as well.
Right, in the first bullet also.
Models
right.
That acute?
Yeah.
Right.
Understood. Okay, any other questions on the goals on slide 13? I'll move to slide 14. So this was, you know, we thought, again, when meeting with Dan and Dr. Struck, that we thought that it may make some sense, you know, to lay out some general guiding principles.
Your slides are actually off a page. Just
yeah, oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, 15.
To add a
new yeah, you had a free shot.
It felt good.
It's just the numbers that are off.
Right. Yeah, yeah, no, yeah, thank goodness for that.
It's just a report from the public.
Yeah.
They're saying, thank you, it's better, but still not great.
Okay.
So just
I'll try to talk louder and get
it.
That thing closer.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll just get closer.
So, again, I just want to stress that, you know, and we labeled this a work in progress because we did not want to prescribe a list of principles. We think that this is something that's important. Thanks, Pat. We think it's important.
There was a reason that I came
yeah.
It's early signs of teamwork.
Yeah, yeah, and they really got it. All right, there we go. Thanks. So this was just really our attempt, right? We would welcome dialogue. We'd welcome thought. It doesn't have to be done right here. We you know, certainly this is something that we can be communicated back to the group. But this was just our attempt at laying down some guiding principles. So if we do get stuck along the way, we can refer back to the principles, and maybe that helps us, you know, work ourselves, you know, out of whatever we're struggling with. So here they are. Innovative payment models and quality initiatives should be, right, transparent, fair, and stimulate broad participation by providers and payers. Promote high-value, quality-driven healthcare services in the proper setting. Create opportunities for both payers and providers to share savings generated if established benchmarks are achieved. Create opportunities for stronger collaboration and goal sharing with Medicare and other payers. Be scalable, flexible to allow all providers and communities, regardless of size, to participate. Advance other MRT objectives, including placing all Medicaid patients into a care management setting within 3 years. Reinforce healthcare system planning and preserve Medicaid safety net providers and care. Actually, that's one that we lifted from our inpatient reform. Dr. Danes felt very strongly about that point. And now I think as things unfold, I understand why. Realign legal, regulatory, and financial barriers to be consistent with reform objectives. That's important. Allow for flexible multi-year phase-in of reform initiatives due to additional systems requirements, IT, but there's many other things I'm sure people can think of. Enable the alignment of quality measures with policy goals. So those were the first set that primarily relate to payment. Moving on, and these are measures that we've worked up, you know, with the help of Haney's. Quality measures should be based on a standard care or evidence-based science. Pay for performance incentives or penalties must rely on measures that are supported by evidence-based. Promote payment approaches that provide due consideration for positive incentives and align with state and federal policies. Accurately identify those aspects of care that are under the healthcare organization's control and be appropriately risk-adjusted to reflect factors influencing outcomes that are beyond the control of providers. Be risk-adjusted where appropriate, and when used for provider comparisons, providers should be incentivized for improvement over time versus comparisons with other organizations. So I think that's a recognition that we should look at each organization and benchmark them to their own performance, not just the whole group. Align incentives, provider responsibilities across the continuum of care. We'll talk a lot about that. Promote patient participation and responsibility in healthcare decision making. Be based on data that is linked across time, place, and setting, and be available for provider use in evaluating and managing patient care services. That's a big one. Yes.
So, can you explain to me the distinction that's made in the first one, this page? That we can can use a standard, quote, a standard care or evidence base on the one hand.
Yeah.
Except for payment incentives, it's evidence based. So standard of care means what? Local standard of care is acceptable as opposed to evidence based. I'm a little puzzled by the distinction.
Yes, I believe so. I think the point that we're trying to go, you want to go ahead, Kathy?
Yeah, sure. I think actually what happened was when we were trying to abbreviate some of these bullets that we merged together two different thoughts here. But one was that we need to be able to measure all the based on the evidence and science that are available. And paper performance programs also ought to be using their science. Having said that, we also recognize that the science changes over time. Measures need to be flexible enough to accommodate new science. So paper performance measures should penalize providers when they are providing care that is in the best interest of the patient, even though, you know, some of the details around the metrics may not yet be caught up with the most current science.
Okay, so I understand it now, but I don't think that's what this says. So
I think we could clarify. So
what you're saying is in order to accommodate flexibility in changing science, and perhaps because of the process of endorsing approving measures, the slowness of that process, to sort of address that gap between the recognition that the science has changed and actually changing the measure.
Sorry, this is Greg Allen. We're really wrestling with this. The basic benefit group is also wrestling with it. So I think
at the
larger MRT meeting, I think it would be appropriate for the payment group and the benefit design group to come together on how to create payment incentives to apply evidence-based practice. I think that would be very helpful, because I think the basic benefit group is going to come forward with a set of recommendations about A, promising stuff that we should figure out a way to incentivize, less promising stuff that we should figure out a way to disincentivize, and very specific recommendations in that regard. And then B, a process for continuously looking at the benefit and how to support it. So that bullet, I think, is a nice crossover between the groups that perhaps the larger MRT could be a platform for bringing them to work together.
Yeah, but as I recall from the benefit committee, evidence-based is sort of more with a preferred methodology than local standard of care. And in fact, that was the least preferred methodology, as I recall. So it's sort of, I think maybe we want to strike standard of care from this or put it second.
I think it would be standard of care. There is very little, in fact, evidence-based standards out there. I mean, when you look at much of the standards of care that are used across hospitals and other healthcare providers, they're based on how a doctor or a provider of care looks at a particular diagnostic entity and builds upon the clinical aspects of making decisions. And I'm not so sure that you can always link evidence-based measures with those standards of care. So it would appear to me, at least, that the standards of care, when you begin to change them, can have profound impacts on how operationally things are done, and making those changes to the extent that there is evidence, you may want to incentivize, but at the end of the day, it is a large task to change the standards of care, and we should be looking to see that the standards of care across the industry, I think, are consistent with best practice, not necessarily evidence-based science.
I think it's important to point out that probably three-quarters of what we do in medicine, say with humility, is without evidence-based. So I think that's being said here. So we need to say that. I think there's an intention here. I read an intention here to create flexibility. I think flexibility is very important because there are unintended consequences of things that we put into place. I'll give you a very easy and clear example. One of the CMS measures is time to antibiotics in emergency. Well, that's excellent, except for the fact that in lots of circumstances, you get people on the wrong antibiotics,
because you have, you're kind of compelled to make a quick decision, and you pressure resistance. So without getting into the deep resistance to antibiotics, okay, and then you get untreatable infections. So I'm not trying to, I think we need to be flexible, and that should be the guideline, and we should learn from what we do as a community as we go along and try to target the goals with that spirit. I think trying to figure out how to mastermind, you know, the perfect circumstance is not going to come to be. We're just trying to improve the system.
That's for today, really, Art. I mean, I think this is a good point. We have a lot of information to move ahead on, and I think Greg or Steve Hall pointed out the language here and the concepts need to be refined. I think we might move that to another part of our discussion. Okay.
When you talk about risk adjusted where appropriate, when used for provider comparison, providers should be incentivized for improvement over time versus comparison with other organizations. It seems to me you'd want to incentivize improvement and an absence standard, because if somebody's at that standard and somebody's not, you're going to give them money to improve and not reward the person who's done it already.
Yes.
I'm reading into what is written. I'm not sure it's what was intended, but there is a conflict here because it's hard to control for socioeconomic status. So you can be treating an illness. You could be treating somebody for heart failure at the Mayo Clinic, and they flew there, and they fly back to a very solid circumstance. And it's not comparable to lots of circumstances in New York State or New York City and so forth. So there is some value to comparing yourself to yourself.
I absolutely agree, but should be probably
There's an important way that one could blend these two strains, national standards, national outcomes, and local improvement, because the comparison to self is probably the best corrector for things that impact health far more than the medicines you give and the care you provide.
There's just one other thing I'll throw out there, and this came up maybe in our discussions, is that, you know, should quality measures, you know, be more of a regional orientation or different from region to region? I think it's one thing to think about. And one thing that we've had some discussion about is, you know, does it make sense for all insurers, to the extent they can, to try to coalesce around a common set of measures, to the extent that, you know, hospitals and other providers within a given region know what it is that the goals are that they're trying to achieve across different types of payers. So it's just something that we throw out there, because some of the things we hear is that hospitals are chasing after Medicare standard over here, Medicaid over here, somebody else over here. Is there a way for us to come at least have a core set across providers, right? And it's a big concept, and it requires cooperation from others, but we've been having, you know, some of that thinking.
Well, let me just take a scope of discussion question, and it really flows right off that. Go over to the payment side. Is the vision that we have that we are talking about Medicaid, we know Medicare is engaged in a number of conversations, and we are thinking inclusively about all payers in this conversation, not necessarily all doing the same thing, but the vision that you have on the payer side is to be inclusive of the major government programs and the private sector.
Yeah, I certainly think that's one of the things we should talk about and see if we can develop our thinking.
The private side seems to be moving that way anyway, but to the extent we can standardize these, recognize both the performance as well as the improvement. That's what I heard. We have to do both.
I think wherever possible, we should have one.
It's really easier to look at it across all payers, because it's not your chief.
The only thing that I consider is, I think it's easier, but I think that any individual institution's negotiation with a private payer should be less. And one may say in that negotiation, I want to use those measures. But you also want to have the flexibility to say, well, if I use these measures, will you give me more money or less money or whatever? I mean, there's a discussion there. I don't think that the state should necessarily be intruding itself in that discussion. I think that if you get some standardization, Medicare and Medicaid, that we're doing the same thing, then I think it's up to us in our negotiations to do that.
But that would be a very important policy choice to make.
Yes.
And that's not the only way you can look at the policy.
Okay, so we have these top two, still have questions. Can we get through the rest and move on? I'm not being facetious. I mean, I think the first two have questions we'll need to think through with or give thoughtful consideration to. Okay, John, I think you're on page 17 in our book, or 18 in our book, and 17 in yours.
Yeah. Thank you. Dan, did you want to go through the...
Well, to pick up on some of the federal...
Wait, there's two approaches here. The federal budget challenge with a weight and then there's capital three. Ours looks very different.
They're challenged to get across it. They're challenged to squeeze this all we
can. One is more optimistic than the other.
Well, I think, last night, or yesterday, we saw the latest iteration of the impact of the deficit when the president put out his jobs program and the cost of that, invited into the work of the super committee. And I was just jotting down a couple of things this morning from the press statement. And $248 billion in Medicare cuts, $72 billion in Medicaid cuts. So among those, this is, speaks to Steve's point earlier, Dr. Safer's reduced payments to skilled nursing facilities, long-term care hospitals, rehab facilities, and home health agencies. So here we're talking about, forget about acute care for a second, getting outside. No increases in updates until 2021.
That's two and a half times what the sequestration impact. And that's only a basement.
Right.
Anybody in this room believes that's where it'll level out. I'd like to know why. The president has offered it as a basement, and it really is further evidence that New York will not be favored as this place. It's a net transfer of money.
Yeah. Awesome. So we have the, point, obviously, as well, it's also more co-payments, right? It's not just about the institution. $100 co-payments, home health for an episode of care. You have higher contributions from beneficiaries into the Medicare program. There's a big hit on the drugs, but I think somewhat probably some of it warranted, in my view, in providing the Medicare to benefit from the same kind of rebates Medicaid. When you get to the hospital side, you have, still all payers, eliminating phasing down provider taxes, which in effect support all the pools that we're talking about, whether it's from the commercial side or the private side or hospital contributions and so forth. So in 2015, they go to 6%. We're just a hair under that now, about 0.5% under, I think. We're about that, but it goes to 4.5. So even New York would be instantly over from current 6 down to 4.5. By 2017, they're down to 3.5%. So a lot of my members on first hearing this in the hospital were said, oh, good, we hate those assessments anyway. But now when you explain to them, those are Medicaid match, that creates our GME and our bed debt and our charity care and our various sicker pools, all of a sudden the realization of what this could mean, not just in New York, but the states all over the country becomes pretty ominous. Of course, the Medicare, we already had. We estimated about $12 billion to $15 billion, depending on how things played out, in cuts from the Affordable Care Act. We're not exactly sure this morning, we have to price it out, what the impact of this would be. But when it was talked about in the context of the deficit reduction, raising the ceiling, and the focus was so intensely on GM, on indirect medical education, and DISH, the numbers for New York ran, depending on whose analysis, at least a low double-digit number, probably $10 billion. So you have the Affordable Care Act. We have administrative reductions they've been taking since then, and county nursing homes on top of everybody else, about $15 billion to $10. So the next slide is not intended to be a predictor. This is simply saying, in the event that the Supreme Court were to say that the mandate is unconstitutional, that's what the chart would look like. Because what the chart doesn't show is the benefit of the mandate of getting people insured. So, in other words, hospitals in New York today are about minus 1% on Medicare. If you took away the mandate, the first instinct, I believe, on the part of the Congress is to say, well, we don't want to eliminate the reforms, right? So we'll keep all of the other reductions and the anticipated savings from ACOs and all of that we'll keep, and we'll expect them to hit the targets. Well, if that happens, and you reduce the dish, and you reduce update factors, and reduce medical education, and then you end up at 2019 at minus 20%.
I thought earlier you were alluding to the fact that the coverage issue in New York State really wasn't going to provide very much.
Well, we don't know. It's certainly going to be less than other states because we have a higher scoring in this population.
Right. So that, I mean, my view has been that the coverage issue is almost useless to New York State because if a patient doesn't have Medicaid, they are uninsured and they come in the hospital, most of us work very hard to get them onto Medicaid and can get Medicaid. So the incremental revenue is de minimis in terms of people getting more
medical.
I don't know what
without immigration reform, you cannot look to a large impact in New York State.
Okay, but you're also, I'm not saying it's dramatic, but it's not de minimis either. Because you also have a lot of the private, well, maybe in the Bronx. But overall in the state, you also have a lot of the private sector terminating employment. And people will now be able to avoid, looking like the Bronx, because they'll be able to theoretically go to an exchange and have their care subsidized. So we don't know. We don't know what the line is. I'm just saying, if you remove the mandate, this is what it looks like.
And I'm saying if you got the mandate on, I don't think it looks significant.
Yeah, I guess it depends on where you are.
But the point, the web, this was my original point, the web of very complicated payment streams in New York State, and clearly probably only a few people in the room who know them all, and they're very complicated, have added up to a safety net so far that we've been able to provide care for a very complicated population. It's underinsured, uninsured, the whole gamut. And what you're describing, Dan, for at least the challenged communities, which are large, is basically the trapdoor goes away. The dish payments and the other things that are taken out to fund new health insurance in other states. All I'm cautioning us is as we start to peel the onion away, we could cause more damage. We can engineer it very smartly and get the wrong outcome.
Right. That's right. And I don't know whether the number is going to end up being minus 15 or minus 10, but I just think people should understand that New York State already was at risk before the debt ceiling.
And maybe that's exactly the point. The Affordable Care Act has a balance built into it. And Steve looks strategically at that balance. And I guess in a little bit of a sense, I don't want to sit here and say, well, if the mandate goes away, then somehow the other pieces aren't there, because that is, at least in its totality, in balance. And there is an effect on New York. And it's an effect in which we receive some benefit. There are targeted costs that clearly affect us. And then there is a new debate that is driven by a deficit reduction factor. And I think it's just important in the conversation, since the debate about what to do about the Affordable Care Act is a very active debate.
Right.
It's just important that we focus on what it does and then focus on the additional points which are now being advanced as part of the deficit reduction. And starting with the president's comments. So, I mean,
sure.
We've got a couple of different things here and have to sort out.
Right. I just want to say the point of the slide was to show how severe the situation is. And I didn't want to be accused of presenting the worst case without caveating that, in fact, there'd be some relief. It may not get us to where we want to go. But clearly, the primary savings will come from reforming the system. And neither Republicans nor Democrats have talked about walking away from the restructuring piece. Yes, ma'am.
I don't disagree with the very large concerns of the governor. I do want to take a little bit of issue with just focusing on the math of dollars in and out. You know, emergency inpatient Medicaid made from a dollars perspective.
Built into the fabric of these discussions, it would appear to me, needs to be a test that looks at what the fiscal impact is to whatever sector reform is hitting, so that you can make a determination as to whether or not that sector is still viable. Because all of these reforms, at the end of the day, will result in revenue reductions to whatever sector is being affected. And I think you need to have an acid test at some point to say all of these reforms make sense, and after they're implemented, there's still an industry out there to provide services.
Right. Okay, next slide. Wait,
No, let's move on.
It's worth a tease. Come on, it's worth a tease. So the one guy in the room this morning who should feel good about the president's proposal is Rick Abrams, because part of this is at least making sure that the 30% or 31%, whatever it is, physician cut and made it sure doesn't take place.
Right? If he's taxing hospitals that even employ physicians to pay for it. So I'm not sure that makes sense.
And you know, see, and this will get to my point. That again, you got to look at this globally. But my point is, Joe, you talk about a litmus test. But, you know, it seems to me that the litmus test, because even, the few slides, and they didn't want to write things there, to a degree, we're still, and again, I use this word, but please take no offense, we're micromanaging the process. It seems to me that the litmus test in the focus is something I learned early in my career in healthcare, and that is the goal of any good healthcare policy is to provide the right care at the right time in the least restrictive setting at the lowest possible cost. To me, that's the litmus test. And it just seems to me that when you talk about guiding light, that's the guiding light. And each and everything that we look at, it needs to be focused on that. And then once you do that, then, of course, you get to the questions of, is the package or is the care robust enough or appropriate enough? What's the fiscal impact on other players or other providers of care along the continuum? And my hope is that, quite frankly, we'll get a primer, because I haven't dealt with an 1115 waiver in 8 years since I left long-term care. But it would be my hope that as we move through this process, and presumably we prepare a waiver, maybe that waiver application, that hopefully we can build in as much flexibility as we can that really takes us to that guiding light and really recognizes, and this gets to the standard of care and evidence-based care discussion, that healthcare politics certainly is local, but healthcare absolutely is local. And I believe that we have the infrastructure in this state that we don't need to build the infrastructure so that the hospitals are working with the doctors and with the long-term care facilities here to really try to do this together. And maybe what came out of the first phase, and that is global budgets, is the way to go, because it seems to me, and I will stop in a second, Dan, but it just seems to me that the one thing that is crippling everybody around this table, and indeed nationally, is the lack of certainty in the system, whether it's good or it's bad. If you know it, you have some kind of idea what the future holds, at least you can plan for it.
Right. So, again, providers were basically spared phase one. We now see more of phase two on the table. I think we just go to the next slide. So, based on the prior deficit reduction plan, not necessarily the one last night, which we haven't totally priced out, but a lot of it has been picked up from the deficit plans. You have GME. Are vulnerable to the 13 million billions over 10. I got to learn to talk in trillions and billions. And bad debt close to half. And of course now there's a potential for changing FMAP and doing a blend of the various states' methodologies with a national number.
That's also unknown. And as I said earlier, the provider tax cap. So go ahead, learn more. And this is just a note that everything's being carefully monitored for any kind of medical necessity and coding, which as you can see, from October to June, they picked up $575 million in overpayments nationwide. But I think the point here is that to the extent that we can factor in what is happening at the national level to what we do at the state level, this is about dollars, as somebody mentioned. But we also, I think, at least I would like to see, that unlike my first 20 years in New York running Haney's, it always felt to me like we thought we were so different, that we had to do everything totally different. And we, I think, fell so far behind the pace of change in the country that by the time we got into 97 and 98, we were so disadvantaged because we simply were not part of the landscape that had transformed itself. Now we've caught up, and we even have institutions that are kind of leading the way for some of these reforms. In fact, Steve, who usually sits somewhere to my right at the Haney's board meeting at Montefiore, has an application to be an ACO. I think you have
it. I moved to the left again.
Joe McDonald at Catholic Access in Western New York is going down this week to talk to CMS because he's made all the cuts, so it looks like they'll become a pioneer ACO. But in every case, when you talk to the people who are on the leading edge, whether they are running very large physician groups or health plans or some of these emerging provider multi-sector entities, they speak to the need to invest and the capital investment that's needed up front to develop the integration, to put in place the IT, to induce the physician collaboration one form or another, and at times take risk. My anxiety here is even while I complimented our congressional reps earlier, and none of them are on the committee. And so, as Steve said earlier, I think we need to be really prudent as we go through the next couple of months here to make sure that we are understanding the intended and the to the extent we can estimate the unintended consequences of what might happen in Washington and factor it in so that we're not putting, in fact, a transition at risk because you don't have the capacity to engage in it. One of the CEOs said to me the other day, you know, Dan, it's Haney's fault that we're in this. Really, what did I do now? Well, we're at point A, and you didn't define a vision of point B. And because we don't know the vision of point B, government is just wandering around. If you had a definitive vision, it would be there. And my response was, you know, considering I spoke at your board twice, I'm a little disappointed, because we absolutely know what point B is. We just don't know how to get from A to B. But point B is a world where quality and payment are tied, where care is integrated, where this is spectrum working on behalf of the patient. It's Burwich Triple Aim. There's a very clear vision. Quality is going to be something you're held more accountable for publicly. There's going to be a drive to decrease acute care use and nursing home use. This is about demand destruction of inpatient care. And you either position yourself for it or you don't. And I don't know how to help you today to get from A to B. We're going to all experiment with that. There's going to be lots of demos and so forth. But we know where point B is. So don't pretend you don't know just because you can't get there right now. What we need to do is help people get from point A to point B. That's in my view. And to the extent that the payment mechanisms and the reform incentives and the way we monitor and measure people and the way we fight like hell to preserve what we have in New York, whether it's the state of New York or the providers in New York or the consumers in New York, fight like hell. We're not fighting to maximize their money. We're fighting to buy time so that we know how to engage in this transition. And I think that, to me, is, you know, frankly, a bias I have coming in here. How do I help shape that future and a pathway to it, and how do I help people preserve what they have to get there? That's it on the federal side.
Okay. Now what we thought we would do is spend a little bit of time kind of laying out the landscape in terms of federal and state innovative payment options. The Obama administration worked with Congress to develop its Office of Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. And from the state's perspective, when they created this office, we were quite pleased because there is a disconnect between Medicare policy and Medicaid policy. We see it throughout. But as we get into a couple of slides here, we'll articulate for you or try to explain to you the connection from a payment, a patient perspective. We have 700,000 people in New York State that are receive their insurance through both programs, and we'll also explain to you the amount of money that gets spent on these what we call dual eligible populations. So we looked at the creation of the CMMI as an opportunity. I'm sure others here would agree. I think one thing that we're noting is that, you know, they're a great group of people. I think we characterize them as being, you know, friends of New York, willing to, you know, help us out. But, you know, we need to push them along a little bit. After we define what we want to get out of this process, I'm sure we'll be, you know, speaking to them about, you know, a waiver or what we think the new direction is. But the goal of this new group is test innovative payment and service delivery models, and we'll talk about that, while preserving or enhancing the quality of care for those who get Medicare, Medicaid, or CHIP benefits. The office, I guess, comes with it $10 billion over 10 years, so there's resources there that we can potentially tap. And then the current initiatives we'll talk a little bit more is the Medicare Pioneer ACOs, and Dr. Sethier, I'd ask, you know, needs a little help there in terms of your experience, and then the Medicare Bundled Payments for Care Initiative. So CMMI, again, is a new state or a new federal department that we think is there to help us address, you know, some problems. This next one is innovative payment models. When I look at it, we kind of arrange this in terms of a puzzle. I have a 9-year-old. He thinks of the world in terms of Legos. And maybe Legos is a better way, because I think some of these things here are building blocks, you know, for something in the future. And as Dan had mentioned, we have a whole glossary in the back, you know, that provides a little bit, you know, more definition. But, you know, health homes, Greg will talk a little bit here in the back about, you know, health homes and the progress that we're making there. Bundling is basically, it's a predetermined payment around an episode of care, and it's really, I think the intent of it is try to get hospitals and doctors, you know, working together to provide better care, better quality care, and then the financial benefit from that would accrue, you know, to the partnership. And there's different, CMS has issued a letter over the summer. They have different models for which they're asking, you know, states to consider developing bundled payments. Phil and I were actually asked by CMS whether we want to be in a bundling interstate bundling work group. We've kind of put them to the side basically to see what comes out of this work group, if this is something that we want to pursue. But, you know, that's bundling. Gain sharing versus shared savings. Dan is educating me on the distinction, because they're important distinctions, but gain sharing is really, you know, payments that are shared among providers. And again, I think there's been some pretty innovative models that have been developed. I think New Jersey and Continuum may be one of those models where, you know, doctors and hospitals are partnering to provide better care, and to the extent that there are savings being generated from those efforts, they share in those savings. And then the shared savings, which is really an agreement among, you know, payers and another entity, providers, in terms of, to the extent that we measure a baseline and there's savings that are generated off that baseline with quality benchmarks being achieved, then there's an arrangement where those percentage of the savings is shared between the payer and the provider. Patient-centered medical home. Again, we have some slides here that, you know, articulate that in terms of what New York State Department's been doing there. I mean, I think we've had this, you know, vision within the health department that really all Medicaid patients, you know, should have, you know, a doctor or a clinic's office, you know, that they can call their own. And, you know, we think that that's, you know, important. I've been, you know, teased in the past about, you know, making comments about, you know, that statement. But I think it's important that, you know, every Medicaid patient have, you know, a place where they can call theirs to receive their, you know, health care services. Accountable care organizations, you know, we'll talk more about that. And, you know, clinical integration is an effort that I think, you know, Haney's has, you know, spearheaded in the past, which is, again, focusing on hospitals and doctors working together on the development of clinical protocols. And we've seen it used very effectively in New York State healthcare systems, as, you know, other states and other health networks that use that to make significant turnarounds in performance and quality. So that's the puzzle. The next one is, I think I call this the healthcare Parthenon. It's you know, basically to lay out, you know, what we think is, you know, the overall, you know, getting to point B is, you know, increased healthcare value, which is improved quality and reduced costs. The tactics to get there, again, we'll talk about others during the course of the discussion here, but the tactics to get there, value-based purchasing, preventable readmissions, reduce hospital-acquired conditions, geographic variation, medical homes, primary care, chronic care management, bundled payments, ACOs. And then what do you need to get there? Information technology, plus I'm sure some other things that we'll identify here as part of our discussions. The next one here, we call it the champagne glass. It's, you know, basically these are all the different federal demonstrations that are in play. I think some of them have more promise than others. Some we don't really understand why they're there. The Medicaid pediatric ACO demonstration we think is supposed to follow the larger ACO, but it's aimed at Medicaid, you know, pediatric services only. The Medicaid emergency psychiatric demonstration, I from reading the what's been produced by CMS, we think that's limited to 8 states, the 3-year demo. It's really aimed at those hospitals that basically meet the IMD definition, Institute for Mental Diseases. They treat primarily just psychiatric, provide primarily psychiatric care, very little acute care, but there's a demo there for which the CMS will pay them a bonus payment if they redirect patients to away from their emergency room. So we don't think that really has, you know, doesn't offer much opportunity, we think, for New York State. Medicaid global payments, again, that was in the reform bill. It's a 5 states are eligible to participate. I've had some conversations with HHC about this, but it's, and we think that it was placed into the bill because certain states, you know, wanted to, certain states that have large public safety net networks wanted to experiment with this notion of global payments, which is, you know, pay a fixed amount for a person that's in your network. That's out there. I think it runs through 2012. Bundled payment, I talked a little bit about that. And then the dual eligible demonstration, we'll definitely talk more about that later on in the slide. So that's really from our view of what's been, you know, in looking at the federal reform legislation and other opportunities that have been put forth by the federal government. But we try to capture that all.
Yeah. John, yes. Can you distinguish the Medicaid Global Payment Demonstration for just managed and managed Medicaid that we have already?
Yeah, I think the notion of the global payment is it's supposed to be actuarially based. But the idea behind it is that the qualifying safety net hospital or network would receive, you know, a global, you know, payment. So I don't think there's really much distinction between that.
Over and above where there's Medicaid managed care mandate, people that are in managed care.
It's not really defined. It's really something that's been a matter of discussion as to what it is. And we've been in ongoing talks with a couple of other systems about possibly making a proposal, but there's no really clear guideline on that. We're thinking of it, and it varies by state, so we're thinking of it more along the lines of what we do with managed care with our plan, where it's more provider-based, provider-controlled type of managed care as opposed to a separate entity. I think in reality, it's not that much different. So, Sergeant, how does whether there's some opportunity in terms of funding for that, whether it's different from the kind of Medicaid payments you get now is all to vote for this stuff, and it's not really clear that they're voting.
Sorry, so HAC is participating or not participating?
We're sort of partnered with a couple of us and with CMS about the program.
But there were a couple of states that really were pushing for it on the political front, right?
Yeah.
It was
Massachusetts,
yes.
Did they have already capitation for Medicaid? They have their Massachusetts,
every single day, yeah, capitation. Maybe we could use it for the exempt populations.
There aren't going to be any.
But to your point earlier that to manage anybody's care takes money, people, and time. I think the time and money is always left out. It's nice to just put all these the million people in to manage care. We should, but it's not like you just switch a switch and it just works. So maybe there is money here for that.
But in this system of particular provision to have a demonstration for public safety net,
okay.
Some of the intent. And what funding are
maybe?
Does that go on to CMMI?
Yeah.
So then it's probably $10 billion.
They're not using any of the $10 billion in Pioneer.
I'm sorry, they're not, were they?
No. It's interesting. There is $10 billion.
Right.
But they have evidence, no initiative
to use it.
Well, that's an opportunity. That is, as we look at these federal demonstrations, and the same is true on the long-term care side, too, on community first choice. The question, I think, of how these demonstrations work in a state that has such a large managed care penetration is kind of on the table. And I know certainly the Department of Health staff has raised that question as they talk to HHS about a number of these demos. And I'm not entirely sure, at least from the conversations I've been part of, that HHS is quite ready to answer that question. I think it's an important part.
Right, but it's also an opportunity then to help shape the mold, how they're looking at this, and maybe it's an opportunity for HHC to have access to funding.
That
question has been a lot of the discussions that we've had about how managed care could work, or in their state versus what we're doing. And a lot of what they propose that they want to do in our mind is sort of getting close to what we have under our managed care model.
But it's also important, too, as remote interest to argue for a long while there, because, look, I think so many of us have been part of a transitional process. At least my experience is, if you really want to be honest about it, that as you transition from one system to another, early on, it actually costs you more. And so you've got, hopefully we can be practical here, and it does cost you more, whether it's moving from an institutional based human services delivery to a community, it costs you more. So if you can build that reality into that glide path implementation, if indeed we have that kind of flexibility, to me, my experience is it's key to success in the final outcome when you're looking for Medicaid recipients.
I think in the spirit of the Lego metaphor, strategic advantage we may have is to think about what monies might be available from CMMI and/or CMS that could come to the state that could be bolted on to other demos or pilots or initiatives that a variety of us may or may not do. So two examples. I put Pat's example, which I thought you were using to argue with something I said, but is a great example. If we could somehow garner emergency medicine Medicaid dollars, basically someone gets no care, has not part of the system, shows up in a hospital bed, and we get them on emergency Medicaid, turn it around. We can save money and drive towards that outcome of the population that's at the moment precluded from insurance because of immigration issues. Or the second one, the dual eligibles. 700,000 that have 25% impact on Medicaid, or some enormous amount of money. You can't deal with CMS, in my estimation. It's not what I would say to them, but you can't deal with them because Medicaid and Medicare, CMS, have no ability to work with each other. But if the money was transferred to New York State, and New York State capitated or did shared savings or did something that could do with the dual eligibles, I think we have an advantage. So I think we should look to those kinds of opportunities because they will build upon whatever any of us do and lower the spend.
Yep.
Beyond the home health model, is there any other dual eligible? It's
actually the next slide here, I think, if we want to go to that. So we
That's more than 20.
Yeah. It's actually
a lot of money.
Yeah. Actually, I'm on the one. States receive right, a letter from CMS, from CMMI, and basically inviting 15 states. There's others that can participate, but really there are 15 states that they targeted. And basically asked us, do we want to, participate in some sort of dual eligible demonstration? And we were very excited, actually, to receive the letter because New York State is one of those, 15 states. And there's others. There's some of the more innovative states in the country were also on that list. But in their letter, which we can certainly make available to anybody who's interested, is that they lay out two models. One is what they call, the managed care model, which is basically a three-way contract between CMS, the state, and health plans, where I think exactly what Dr. Zafir just suggested here is that there could be a capitated payment arrangement, whereby the three parties join together, say, here's the capitation payment arrangement. I think they're envisioning, even though they don't say how much they want to skim off the top, but there would be some sort of capitation arrangement specifically designed around the duals, right? We'll show you the next chart, which will show the kind of money that we're talking about here, but that is a significant, proposition. The next is called, managed fee-for-service. It's a retrospective performance payment. The way that generally works is, we would draw a line with CMS saying this population would cost X. We measure our performance in terms of cost and quality against that line to the extent that their savings, savings get calculated, pooled, and shared. So there's really, again, they're laying out two opportunities. They're trying to target, specific states. I think in their mind, they think 1 to 2 million dual eligibles. Is what they have in their mind. We may want to think larger. We may want to even put a variation on the managed care approach where, perhaps it's the state goes at risk and, we work out that arrangement, with CMS. So it's a variation of their proposal. So
that, they are open to sort of non-insurance-based kinds of models. I mean, I'm thinking of Montefiore. You have a long-term home health care program. I mean, you probably got, 700 patients in there. I bet everyone is dually eligible. If you got the Medicare payment for them also and had a fully integrated program, it's a provider-based model that works successfully. I mean, would the state be interested in those types of build-offs, like the Lego?
Well, I think that's one of the things that we're here to talk about.
Yeah.
Is how do we do that?
I guess the PACE program is a model.
But I
would argue for you taking the risk and controlling the money.
I think that is, certainly something that we, should look at. Something that, has broad implications. We better be sure we got it right because the state's financial plan will be at risk if we don't get it under control. Those are big things that the governor would have to consider. But certainly, I think that's something that we should definitely explore the variation on their option.
Any other initial thoughts on that?
Well, one of the things is I think that the state needs to be open to lots of different models. I mean, Montefiore is very developed in terms of managed care capabilities. They have, there are many institutions that are not. And I think to build that, we may want to build that over time. But it was great expense that were invested for many years.
With big losses.
Yes, in the early years. I remember that. I think that it's important to really make sure that we go down multiple paths on this so that we can still take advantage of something like this, but not necessarily be in a capitation mode.
service that.
Do you have, and maybe you get to this later, data in terms of that population? I always wonder how much of that population is basically in nursing homes and coming in and out, or how much of it is really out in their homes and just Medicare, Medicaid.
Yeah, I think that that's variant, and it's the sort of analysis that we would have to do. Like, you know, Pat Ruin is working with Melanie Bell, who heads up CMMI, and we think it's very important. And we get this file that has, we know the Medicaid, you know, we know the 700,000. Next slide will show you how much we spend on these people. But we also, we need to match that file up to the Medicare side and get a better understanding of, you know, how this population accesses services and what, you know, and where are the opportunities, you know, for savings. So, and we've been looking at, you know, readmissions and avoidable admissions that are coming from nursing homes into the hospitals, because obviously that would be an area where you could perhaps achieve, you know, some savings. And we would need to get a handle on that information, I think, you know, collectively, and, you know, make a judgment if, certainly if the state goes at full risk for the Medicare side of the equation here, right, we'd have to have a pretty good handle on where we think we can end up without putting the financial plan at risk.
Yeah. Yes.
So in addition to being a Medicaid managed care plan, we have a pretty large Medicare Advantage plan and a dual special needs plan with 50,000. I think we're the second largest SNP in the continental United States. It's a unique model.
Yeah, I think, do you want?
Well, I can give it a shot.
Yeah.
There's certainly overlap times. You know, a number of states have been interested in something similar to the municipal option. And the idea, I think, is that as opposed to having a health plan or an intermediary that accepts Medicare risk, that the state actually kind of steps into that role, maybe with an intermediary that they share the risk for large providers to share the risk with. So I think, you know, in some respects, this is Melanie Bella, and we're very glad she's in the dual role. She works with us on some of our dual programs in New York. I think that's some of what they heard and some of what we see reflected in the letter. So there's clearly overlap. I think that the reality is that the programs like the Medicaid Advantage Plus, which many of us in the room spent a lot of time and effort implementing in a voluntary mode,
Okay, any other questions there? So this is our chart. It could be one of the more important chart in the entire deck, I think. And it's interesting because we've had quite a few conversations with CMS, the Office of the Actuary, Kaiser, right, trying to understand what's the overlap of the dual eligible population between the two programs, right? And the sense I'm getting, right, is that I don't think CMS yet has a handle on it. They're willing to try to, you know, they were a little embarrassed, I think, you know, yesterday when we pressed them, right, because we said this is very important, you know, to us it's very important to get a handle on this. I think they were very, you know, cooperative in terms of helping try to develop the number. That's certainly something that they, you know, that is their intention. But so this is draft. I have to say that this is our best shot at trying to figure out what the overlap is. But as I said, there's 700,000 people that are dual. And in the note I got back from them yesterday, they had a number very close to 700,000 people. So that was a good sign. They comprise 45% of the Medicaid spending out of the $52 billion, I think is the number that we've you know, been using, right? So it's a lot of money. And 41% of the Medicare spending. So you add it up, and it's a tremendous amount of money, right, mm-hmm. that is going towards, you know, basically 700,000 folks. So, again, we're going to try to refine these numbers, and we, you know, CMS is committed to, you know, helping us do that. But you can see there that, you know, it's $34.8 billion, I think, is the number.
Maybe we do.
Can
There's
a couple important things to remember, and that is the dual eligible recipient count, that within that category of dual eligible, there's people who are eligible for full Medicaid and people who are not eligible for full Medicaid. They either receive help with paying their Part B premium or they receive Part B premium and some cost sharing. I think the other thing that's important, I don't think I'm missing it here, is that the 45% of Medicaid spending, a significant portion of that is long-term care spending. And with some of the MRP reform recommendations, that will actually, the acute care part of that will actually, I think, go down over time. So I think that's important when we look at the 45% number. It's not really long-term care, something for community services, nursing homes,
I think the only other real quick point I make, when Greg goes through the health home slides, right, and the target population there of 900,000 people that are the, you know, chronic, you know, multiple chronic, tremendous overlap there between the dual population and the health home, targeted health home population.
I would just add, we're targeting CMS product on the dual eligible. Breakout of those categories would be quite revealing. Just in terms of just trying to conceptualize cap the pay to dollar flow.
Mm-hmm. And also knowing what to spend on, like, the elderly duals and the
right,
and
that, I think that would be a very important.
We know that on Medicaid. And on the Medicaid side, it's roughly 1/3 disabled, 2/3 elderly. We don't know on the Medicare side. 2/3 Long-term care.
That's people passing on dollars, right?
I believe that's dollars.
That's the dollars. Okay.
But we can get that. We can drill into the Medicaid side. It's until we get this file and get it and understand it and get it loaded and passed and working very, you know.
I think the state's at risk for it already. And there's nothing... be nothing but opportunity in going at risk. They're at risk. We're at risk. And in fact, it leads to why we needed to cap the Medicaid system.
That's
an amazing statistic.
The numbers are amazing. I think digging into them is what will really help us again what's the intervention? This is what, $50,000 a head on average? Did I get the right zero? So, you know, if they're in a nursing home, that's $100,000 a year Medicaid money, you know, so you have to figure out which population is doing what.
I don't have much.
No, it's a very significant overlap, but I find that confusing to think about. How much will this take care of the home, and what's left over, and what's that composition?
So we really need to put a whole trail together here, breaking this out. Dual eligibles, disabled, elderly, strategies for the long-term care that are emerging with the home, care. So, I mean, this really has a whole trail to the end. Okay.
And personal care spending, too.
I would also say where possible on the health home-identified population, this population, the geographic breakout would be hugely useful by region, because I think the terrain of this issue looks different in New York City and a little bit different elsewhere in New York State, and I'm not necessarily sure the same programming of policy interventions will work equally the same way across regions.
Just want to make a point, Bridget. I think we need to be clear about the terminology or how we use words. I'm not saying you suggested this, but health home is a model or technique for an intervention. It's not an insurance issue. You know what I mean? It's not shared risk. It's not capitation. It's just a mechanism to. It's a very good mechanism, but it needs to have a source of support, and it needs to have compel. And you need to do more to compel change. I guess that's what I'm saying. I mean, if we had health homes for 2 years and everybody set them up and then the shared savings went away, how do you support? What it's about is where we're going, which speaks to what you were saying, Phyllis. I mean, I think what we should look at is there should be a vision for the state at some point for all, perhaps, or multiple models. But we're trying to move the system. We're not trying to create. Health homes sometimes become static. I think that's what I'm saying. It's a great thing if you have a source of payment for it. And combined with capitation, it makes sense. Combined with some other shared savings, it makes sense. Otherwise, it doesn't work. You know, they fall off a cliff. So one is a technique, a very good technique, and the other is a payment mechanism that begins to change the system so that we can live within our means and get better outcomes, by the way.
Well, it appears to me that health home is a two-year scramble.
Right.
It's a revenue stream.
For 2 years.
Which we need to understand how does that and then get the same.
Tumble over a cliff.
And then what would the relationship be between the health home and the MLTCT? Because that, when you talk about the elderly and two-thirds of the money is going towards the elderly, my guess is that a combination of the long-term care component, both the community and the nursing home component, would make up a good number here. So how does that fit in? And I think that the confusing part is the MLTC and the health home integration or not integration, being that it's a two-year kind of program.
MLTC is older.
MLTC is an insurance product for.
From my perspective, the most
right.
Very, very touch. Care management, social support, high touch model. People in the
right.
Kind of self-sustaining.
health hub is kind of living underneath the global, I think, the more global financing of these events. I think I concur with that. 2 years of transition, I think everybody doubts that it is successful enough to be self-funding, essentially, after that 2 year period.
Self-funding in the premium stream,
yeah,
not
right.
Self-funding within
right.
point
well,
of care.
Right.
It doesn't work that way.
But I would say something different, that if those savings were really in the system and if people didn't convert to managed care, that those money should be penciled into the rate structure, that there's going to be fewer services paid for and they should be paid for appropriately. And the money would be available. It may be available for the services prior to that, which would probably keep people out of the hospital. But then when you pay the hospital, you would pay them
next slide.
Yep. So the next slide here is just really, you know, a visual showing that I'm not just talking about just Medicaid here, but you know, the MRT will provide opportunities for shared savings and to shift risk to plan providers over the next 3 years. So this is basically showing that today, the fee-for-service world within Medicaid is $30.6 billion, and capitation is $18 billion. And along the way, what we think we're trying to do here is we move, you know, everybody into a managed environment is shift opportunity and shift risk.
How reasonable, a pace, do you think? I mean, I was just listening to the difficulties of getting these things formulated, even conceptually, let alone practically. You know. And while we have some really dramatic good examples by far, thinking of what providers say, explain to me, Dan, how I'm going to make it through this transition. Because as one does the so, in quotes, right thing and decreases the utilization while I'm trying to build this, you know, multi-tiered model here, no longer covering my fixed cost. Now, in Steve's example, if you're benefiting from the shared savings for a couple of years, great. But at some point, I understand it leads to the need for fewer nursing homes or hospitals. But assuming one is needed, or two or three are needed, I'm wondering how you conceptualize dealing with the fixed variable issue for the sustaining of what is desired to be left behind.
Mm-hmm.
It's just kind of tricky in my mind. So I think with this happening 3 years, it just seems really ambitious and perhaps faster than the design system.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I think, well, the 3 years just comes from, I think that's already been stated as part of one of the MRTs.
Yes.
Right.
And I'm just wondering how,
yeah,
you know, so 6 months later, you know,
right. Understood. And I think I would assume that, you know, Mr. Berger and his, you know, work group is also, you know, struggling with that, you know, same question.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
How do you deal with Brooklyn?
Right. Yep.
Well, most of those dually eligibles are in a fee-for-service system now. I mean, there's only 30,000 in MLTC, another 30 in long-term. So that's a big transition over a three-year period.
And they get terrible care, the ones that are in the fragment system. Because you just bounce all over the place.
Right.
There's no managing of their care, and the outcomes are horrific.
Okay. I can move on. These are, now I'm switching back to, you know, our New York MRT reform options. There's a, you know, various initiatives that are underway. The first one is state action, immunity, and supervision. I mean, this one is important. It's important for healthcare providers that are developing networks to know where they stand legally with respect to, you know, federal antitrust laws. So we have a team of people within the health department, counsel's office, that are looking at this issue. I think it's important that, you know, providers, as they move forward, know the ground rules. We've had some conversations already. One with Montefiore, you know, this week in terms of, you know, how we th- think we plan on, you know, making clear to the public where we think the antitrust lines lay. So that's an important effort that is underway. The Medicaid ACO demonstration in the budget bill that was enacted last year, there's authorization for the commissioner to establish 7 ACO demos. Our position is that we want to make sure that we're moving in lockstep, or certainly not doing anything that's in disagreement with the Medicare ACO approach. We understand that they're going to be releasing their final rule here shortly. There's a lot of criticism around their initial proposal. So our approach is we want to just wait and see where Medicare is coming, just to make sure that, to the extent that the two, there's going to be a Medicaid ACO, which should really try to operate consistently with a Medicare ACO. The chronic illness. Yes, in the legislation that was enacted, there is a provision in there that lays out a framework for the state to work with those interested provider networks that want to become a Medicaid ACO, and the law says, you know, up to 7 in the state. So our concern is, and it was raised during the negotiation with the legislature, that we didn't want to be overly prescriptive in the event that we would be doing something that would be found to be inconsistent with Medicare. Because it doesn't make sense to have one Medicaid ACO and then a Medicare ACO, right, following different rules. Certainly, when we think that one of the things we may want to pursue is, you know, better care for the duals.
Was there about 7 other than being a lucky number?
It was a lucky number.
There was some discussion about desire to have a number. I think the general feeling was 7 was sufficient, but right now, you know,
they could have 18, which is also a lucky number. When we talked about it in MRT1, you know, I was worried we were going to overregulate with New York, and I said, don't kill the unicorn before it gets to New York. So the Fed killed it for us. I think it's real important, you know. Thank God they came out with Pioneer models, so there was option 2. And so despite what I said before about trying to be consistent, the ACO rec is obviously one area where we really need to design something for New York that makes sense for New York. Whatever we end up calling it. And on the first one, where we don't have, where we have a lot of independent institutions, more upstate particularly, we have the downstate example as well. It really lends itself to clinical integration. And one of the difficulties, this is for you, Rick, one of the difficulties in all this is that over the decades, the assumption of policymakers is if we can modify the behavior of the hospital, the physicians will follow. Somehow the hospital board or the hospital management or the medical, somehow the quality will change, the utilization, if we just go after the hospital. And the hope of, I think, whether ACOs or these other efforts of integration, is that it really, for the first time in a meaningful way, begins to focus on the physician and says, you know, you need to be part of this. There's opportunity here, whether it's an employed model, a large physician group, an integrated network, or whatever. So I would hope that when we look at the clinical integration attraction, it's the opportunity to engage the physicians in a really positive way and be presented that way, because there's a long education curve for many who aren't part of these larger systems to understand why this is even happening. And therefore, I would urge that as we define what clinical integration is, or as we develop these other than federal ACO prototypes, that we do so with an eye on engaging the physician in a real constructive way. And how does antitrust work with Medicaid and Medicare? I mean, you could have a healthcare system that was all of New York State, nonprofit, all of New York State, you wouldn't get a penny more from Medicaid or Medicare. Then, I mean, it doesn't, being large doesn't, or being together with physicians doesn't get you one penny more. Antitrust is to prevent unbridled rise in price.
Right.
So how does it work with Medicaid and Medicare? I haven't
figured out how I can get a higher price for Medicare or Medicaid with that, like coming together. We'd all come together.
No, but self-referral.
I've talked to you. That we get a higher, but it doesn't. I understand what you're saying, but it seems so undermining of what might be done that is changing, not raising prices. No.
Okay. Great. The chronic illness demo. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. We have a chronic illness demo that's running now that will eventually phase itself into health homes. It had a very similar population, except it was limited to people that were exempt or excluded from managed care by law. It was set up by law, and this here is a straw dog to look at. It's not a recommendation. This is the way that we set up the shared savings pool for those chronic illness demonstrations. They were care management programs that were targeted at trying to improve care and reduce costs. And essentially what happened is they set up a shared savings pool. In order to be able to dip into that pool as a chronic illness demo provider, you had to meet our baseline quality and reporting requirements. So you had to behave during the demonstration, which all of our demos have been behaving. Then we had this, and I think we would revisit a lot of this, by the way, but I'll just throw it out there for thinking purposes. We had this formula where our aggregate expenses in the demo had to be below 85% of our control group expenses when adding the care management fee on both sides of the equation. So we're basically saying total dollars plus what we were funding for care management, we wanted the experiment group, which is the demo, have expenses that were below 85% of the control group overall in order to sort of trigger the shared savings pool. And you can say that's good, that's bad, if that was the rule. We created a $6 million pool that we would start to distribute in years 2 and 3. And then we would, if you met the quality requirements, you had actually created savings against the control group for your demo, then you would be eligible to dip into that pool, and we'd get you 50% of the savings back from the pool. If when we added up all the demos, their savings exceeds the pool, then we would weight people dipping based on their relative performance to one another. So if one program exceeded on a percentage basis another program's savings, then they would get a larger percentage of the pool based on their peer-based performance. And we're just beginning to add all this stuff now because we're coming through our second year and coming through the end of our third year now. So we don't have a report out right yet on whether we saved anything out that's coming soon.
Okay.
How many people enrolled? I have to get that to you.
Okay. I think it was a learning experience for us. I think, you know, that's, you know, and when we get into discussions about shared savings, is, you know, I think we've benefited from what we've done there. Patient-centered medical home, again, we've talked a little bit about it. This has been very successful rollout for the state. There's 3,800 people or 3,800 recognized providers as of 6/30. Almost 900,000 Medicaid members receive care within a primary care medical home. So this is, you know, certainly we spent considerable amount of money. Has been, you know, built into the managed care premiums, you know, to fund this initiative. So this is, I think, something that's been successful and something that we can, you know, build upon. And then there's the multi-payer initiative. Basically, there's authorization that, you know, the state can, you know, pair up with other payers to establish medical homes. The Adirondack Medical Home is the one I think gets the most attention.
A good example of the state using its antitrust
authority. That's right. Exactly. Yep. Medical health homes, right, Greg will talk more about that later, so I'll jump over that. And clinical integration, you know, we talked briefly about, you know, clinical integration. Certainly a number of states, New Jersey, the Continuum, you know, project, there's others that have realized some benefits as a result of the clinical integration. I think the University of Michigan had a big demonstration that they basically recently reported positive results in terms of better care coordination and savings to the system.
And on a broader scale, the Long Island Health Network is an example of clinical integration crossing all payers and all types of patients.
Okay, so that just takes us to quality. I'm not sure if people want to take a break.
I think we're going to... But let's conclude this discussion, and then we're going to come back after a break for the quality indicators part of the discussion. But are there comments on what has been presented and discussed thus far? Any final comments from anyone? Any issues to be brought up? All right, hearing none, then we will break. There we have a break for lunch, return at 1 o'clock. We'll start the quality indicators discussion then. Turn for a moment.
The leader has disconnected. The conference will be terminated in 2 minutes. The leader has turned lecture off, and your line has been unmuted. The leader has disconnected. The conference will now end.